Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Continue. You've listened to a long and complex case, murder in the first degree. A premeditated murder is the most serious charge tried in our criminal courts. You've listened to the testimony. You've had the law read to you and interpreted as it applies in this case. It's now your duty to sit down and try and separate the facts from the fancy. One man is dead. Another man's life is at stake. If there's a reasonable doubt in your minds as to the guilt of the accused, a reasonable doubt, then you must bring me a verdict of not guilty. Now, if, however, there's no reasonable doubt, then you must, in good conscience, find the accused guilty. However you decide, your verdict must be unanimous. In the event that you find the accused guilty, the bench will not entertain a recommendation for mercy. The death sentence is mandatory in this case.
We're to charge here, and if we vote the accused guilty, we've got to send him to the chair. That's mandatory.
I think we know that.
Let's see who's where.
Yeah,
okay, anyone doesn't want to vote?
Try with me.
Okay, then just remember that this has to be 12 to nothing either way. That's the law. Okay, are we ready? Now, all those voting guilty, please raise your hands. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11. Okay, that's 11 guilty. All those voting not guilty? One, right. 11 guilty, one not guilty. Well, now we know where we are.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
So, what are we doing now?
Well, I guess we talk.
Boy, oh.
Hello, and welcome to Book Versus Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
We are wrapping up January. Wow, what a slog this month has been. Not for the podcast. This has been like the fun part. But whoa, what a month. But we here in this, in podcast land, we've been having a wonderful time doing all movies that have been adapted from dramatic plays or just from not musical theater. And we've had some really great episodes, and we've picked up a lot of new listeners. Welcome, welcome. When the pandemic started, we decided to do a brand new episode every single month. And that means, for the most part, we're looking at shorter literary sources. It could be a novella. It could be a short story. It could be a play, magazine, article. Once in a while, we do a full novel, but not an every week sort of affair. So if you have suggestions, we've got African-American History Month coming up. We've done a lot of them over the years, but there's so many more that we haven't covered. We would love to hear your ideas. And there's a few places where you could interact with us and meet other listeners of this podcast on the internet.
We do have a basic Facebook page. Be sure to like it. All of the episodes are posted there first. Of course, they do go out to all the little podcast channels in the world. We have a private Facebook group. And if you're interested in meeting other members and bouting around ideas, that's the best place to interact with us. And it's Book VS Movie Podcast. Ask to join. And you can leave that in there. We ask that whatever it is, the literary source needs to be something we can get our hands on pretty easily. And also the movie needs to be streaming on a major device. We are the major device. You know what I mean? Major streaming app. We are on Twitter at Book Versus Movie. Also on Instagram, Book Versus and Movie. You can send us suggestions there as well. And we have an old time email, Book Versus Movie Podcast. Spell it all out at gmail.com. We also have some stickers. If you'd like some stickers, let us know. We'll drop them in the mail for you.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, my stickers came yesterday.
Aren't they great?
They're so fun. I love them. Thank you. I'm thinking, like, where can I put them? Maybe I'll put them around Sacramento when I'm there next week.
Yep.
So if you really enjoy the show and you would like to help keep us in books and movies, you can also support us on Patreon. And we have two new Patreons this week. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. So
two members?
Yes. Nice. We've been doing the show for 9 years now. We're putting everything from what we've recorded 2020 and then previous to that, the last few episodes, Patreon episodes we put up are Urban Cowboy, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Double Indemnity, Matilda. There's so much up there. And we want to say thank you to Donna and Joe for joining us. We really appreciate that. It helps us with books and movies, streaming services, the software to put the show together. So you go to Patreon. There's also some free things there if you want to check it out, just to see if, just give it a little look-see. Why not? So it's Patreon. And if money is tight, we totally understand that. If you could just leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts, leave some stars or do whatever they ask you to do, that'd be amazing. And if you give us a 5-star review in iTunes, we will read it on the air. Thank you again.
We were just saying before we got on there that we are so excited to talk about this last episode for plays in January. This is such a great one. And I just want to, like, going back over some of the other plays that we've talked about this month, one of the things that you kind of always see, there's so many that I was just thinking, like, Steel Magnolias, we've not done yet. But whenever you see a
we
movie
did cover
that's
Steel
been,
Magnolias.
We did?
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
We've been
I know.
Doing this so long.
It might even be on the Patreon wall. I'll double check that.
Oh my
but we did.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Did we?
Yes, we did.
I'm sorry, y'all. It's a long time. It's a lot of episodes. But that's a good example too, though. If you say a lot of us are familiar with Steel Magnolias. Typically when a movie has been adapted from a play, one of the things that happens is we get multiple new locations. Because in a movie, you can go to multiple locations. You can be at so-and-so's house. Or like when we talked about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, there's scenes that take place at a roadhouse. That doesn't happen in the play. There's a scene they move the setting to, you know, so it's outdoors. And Steel Magnolias, we're all over that little town, you know. So it's not just in the beauty parlor. I guess the reason we do that is, one, because we can. And two, because there's a sort of this expectation that a movie audience isn't going to sit still for a whole story told in a single room. This adaptation is very different in that it kind of breaks. There's a little bit outside of that room, but it's mostly pretty much exactly. It's pretty faithful to the play. So we're talking about 12 Angry Men and a very, very interesting playwright who I think doesn't get, he's more known as a screenwriter, but this is really quite, it still holds up. It's still fresh. Mm-hmm. It's still provocative. I mean, really provocative. I can see this material starting fights today. Let's talk about Reginald Rose.
Reginald Rose was born December 10th, 1920 in New York City. He's a New Yorker, East Coast kind of guy. He went to City College, Townsend Harris High School. He wrote a few plays. He also wrote quite a bit for Studio One, which was a CBS show in the 1950s. And those CBS, I love those Studio Ones when you can catch them. There's a couple of people who have channels of them on YouTube.
They are excellent.
They are really
so good. They hold up against anything today. We talk about today being like the golden age of television. These things will stand up against The Sopranos. I mean, that's from a while back, but any of the big things that people are talking about today in terms of writing and all of that, it's really something. And the stars.
Well, they got all these theater actors in New York City because all the stuff was done in New York City. And in the 50s, until I Love Lucy, people used to, they would air something live and then kind of tape that and then put that on the West Coast. And then they would get rid of things. They didn't, there was no ideas about reruns and preserving things. Film was heavy. Film was flammable. Film took up space. So people would just be like, oh, these are hour-long shows. Who's going to care? And then you have
Why are
James
we keeping
Dean.
These lying around?
Right. You have like James
Paul
Dean,
Newman.
Paul Newman. These are all like top actors. And then we have the one here. It's 1954, September of 54. And it's 12 Angry Men. And he wrote this when he had served jury duty in New York City. And it was a murder trial. And he was just fascinated by the whole process. And it makes for, it's an hour-long show when you watch it. And to put these things together, I mean, actors are trained to either do commercials or they're trained to do plays. When you're kind of doing both at the same time with a live camera, that must have been...
It was a brand new thing. Right. I can't even, it must have been, everybody was must have been sweating through their shirts
they
behind
had
the scenes.
To. You had to, because not even everybody had a television. It was a big deal. And so they put this on the air in September of 1954. And this is a story about, and in the play itself, they, in the teleplay play, they do start with a judge saying, you have this young man's life in your hands. This is a deep responsibility. Okay, 12 men go into the jury room. And then the rest of the time, we're just in the jury room. In the teleplay, you never find out in the original script what race he is, what his ethnic heritage is.
He's, we just know that this boy, and isn't he a little younger in the play?
16. Isn't he
like, yeah, he's 16. He's 18 in the movie for some reason. In the script, it's very clear that this boy is, belongs to some marginalized community, but it's never ever stated, which I think is so smart. It's mm-hmm. never ever stated explicitly. I was watching, I just thought about this. I was watching a, as one does, I was watching an analysis on somebody's analysis. It was people, you know, on BookTube, on YouTube, people yeah. who talk about books and movies and whatnot. And somebody was doing a book versus movie about this play and the movie. And she said something like she assumed that the kid was Mexican.
In New York?
I was like, what? In the 50s? Like today, okay. But I mean, even when I lived there in the 90s, like there were very few of us around.
You and I hung out in Brooklyn, and you met a Mexican. It was a Mexican woman who was our waitress. And you were like, oh my God, you two were just chattering away. Because it's unusual.
Yeah, I was like, okay, that's weird. But okay, but also, you know, what's so wonderful about that in the terms of this play is that it just shows you that marginalized people, you know, in terms of the society, the people who are in power, who pull the strings and run everything, all marginalized people are basically the same. Like the things they say about one are very often the things they say about another. And it kind of doesn't matter. It just matters that they're not, it's us versus them, which is explicitly said in the play, basically, which I think is really brilliant. I will say this, when I read the play, when I read the script, and I may have read it in college, it's the writing is good. It's good. It's not blowing me away in terms of the quality. I did, without a trace of irony, I was about a third of the way through the play, and I thought, geez, why are these guys so angry? In the play, like when you read it on paper, they're so angry right away. They're instantly furious. And part of that is because one of the things we established, and I always think this is such a great dramatic device. You see this in a lot of really great films, especially. It's hot.
Right.
It's crazy New York, sweaty, icky, goopy hot, and which makes you super cranky. And
we were talking about that.
And I think that's
air.
Great.
Yes. when you get like that hot and there's no relief from it,
you can't think straight.
And you're trying. Right. And you're trying to make a point. You're trying to listen to somebody else. You're trying to be present. And a part of you is just like, open a window, put an ice cube next to my throat. Like, get cool me down. I need to cool down. We should mm-hmm. say also with these plays that they did on TV, they tend to be progressive in a way that was acceptable to people. Like it just was it was a step above what was normally like a sitcom or whatever. It right. tried to defy conventions. Now they did it in a way to not freak out white people, in their audience, but it's pretty darn progressive for this time to explicitly
it's
talk
really
about racism and right and how insidious it can be and how it can change a person's whole point of view. Because to me, I mean, just when I'm on brass tacks, like you said, when you're just reading it and when they're saying out loud, like, this is premeditated, like, there's no way this was a premeditated murder. There's, I mean, the kid, if it was anything, it was a crime of passion.
Yeah.
If anything, if he's guilty. But in the play, he's 16 years old. And then that also brings home the point, like, he's just considered so worthless. Like, he's just, it's like, there's no way to rehabilitate him.
Just one guy's like, I got to go to the ball game. Can we hurry up and decide, like, whether this kid's going to live or die, and so we can get on with things, basically.
The death penalty. And they make that clear over and over again. If you have any reasonable doubt, you have to put that in play. And the number of them that are just like, nah, he's guilty. That smack their hands together and walk away and totally okay with it. And the basic story is that one person stands out and says, no, we have to talk about this more. There's no way we could just plow through this. And there's in the teleplay. Oh, no, that's not that. I also watched another teleplay with Steve McQueen. And so that was another one that was a jury.
When was it from?
It was from Studio One. I got on someone's YouTube channel. Right. But
very interesting.
Yeah. People like a courtroom drama, too, don't you?
Yeah. You know, when we talk about the movie, which we will, but one thing to know about the movie and is that it comes out, I think, in April of 1957, mm-hmm. about not quite 6 months before the very, very first episode of Perry Mason ever airs.
Oh.
So we American audiences today, like you just said, we love a courtroom drama. Americans, I don't know why we're so obsessed with the courtroom, but we love it. I love it. I love it. I will watch it all day long. I will watch Perry Mason for 3 days. But at this time, this was kind of a new thing. So those teleplays that you're talking about from Studio One, like, that was kind of a new, very, very American audiences are seeing this for the very first time on television, at least. Yeah, it's really powerful.
It's live. I can't imagine how terrified those actors must have been. And to get all the moving places around, moving people around, going from this set
to cameras.
That set with the cameras. And then it's just this one set. And they all, I mean, basically, we'll go through the plot quickly and then we'll talk into the movie more about how they adapt it for there. But the tension comes in just like these 12 angry men, and you can make the argument like there's not much differentiation between them, but there is. There is a different reason each one says guilty, and each one.
Yeah.
Has a reason to just kind of like give up on it.
And that's one of the really interesting things about the script is, and another thing we should say is the men in the script, their character names are man number one, man number two, mm-hmm. or juror number
juror
one
number
or something
one.
Like that.
Yes.
Right. They are known by their numbers, and we only learn what one or two of them, what their names are
right.
and what their occupations are. But they are different, but when they come in, our first introduction to them is like, well, we all agree he's guilty, right? Because we all saw the same thing. We all heard all the same evidence. And, you know, he's guilty. Let's just vote him guilty and get out of here. And as you said, even though they all but the one guy, they all agree about that. When they start talking about it, no, they actually, each of them has a different reason why they have come to the conclusion that they have come to. It's not because of the evidence per se. It's because of what they're bringing, their life experience. One of them is an immigrant. One of them is an ad man. One of them is kind of a wallflower. The other one's like super angry, beaten down by life and is estranged from his, you know, they all have these stories that they're bringing into the jury deliberation room with them. The other thing that I think is very interesting is that the script takes place in real time. Mm-hmm. We are with, there's no like later that day, in fact, in the break between when act one ends and act two begins, I think it says in the script something like immediately following act one.
Right.
So it's no passage of time. It's just that's when you have to break it sometime. And this is where we've broken the script up. And throughout from the very beginning, these men, this is where I was like, why are they so angry? Jeez. These men are like, ugh. This is taking forever. Can we please? Oh, I don't want to go over this again. It's taking so long. It's not even 2 hours.
Oh, no, it's an hour and a half, maybe.
Yeah, maybe that, depending on how fast they talk. And to decide whether this young boy lives or dies, I did a little bit of internet looking up. And do you know how long the jury in the O.J. Simpson trial deliberated?
I don't remember. I remember it happening, but I don't remember.
Me either. And I was very surprised to see it was 4 hours. So more than twice as long as this.
Wow.
And just so we have a point of reference, the Scott Peterson murder trial, that jury deliberated for 7 hours. And a trial that you covered on one of your other podcasts, which at the time was, I think, the very first time we talked about the trial of the century, the Stanford White murder trial.
Yes.
That jury deliberated for 47 hours. So 90 minutes. Oh, 47 hours. And I should add what was his name? The murderer. The guy who shot Sanford White was an architect. The man who shot him in front of a ton of people.
Yeah.
So many witnesses. 47 hours to deliberate that. And he got off.
And he did get off. And it was also because they were talking about the woman and her reputation and what.
Yes,
because
it was over a woman.
It was over a woman. So there was that whole mess with it. Yeah, we never see in the play, they don't tell us what he looks like. They don't give us any indication. But then we find out that one of the jurors grew up in pretty much the same neighborhood or a neighborhood just like it, and is offended when they are talking about being in the slums and being a slum kid. And and then he brings that up. And then, well, I think like some of them think that they're following the evidence and or trying to be very rational about it.
And the way that the play presents it, I think, is so smart, too. So we, again, as the audience, like Margot says, the play starts with this judge, and it's really just a voiceover, basically, of a judge saying, like, okay, now, you men, time for you to decide whether this boy is guilty of murdering his own father. And that's all the details we have until we go into that room. And we're learning the details as they're coming out in the conversation between the jurors. And so when one juror will say, well, what about the guy downstairs? He heard the boy yell, I'll kill you. And then he heard a body hit the floor. And then he saw the boy run out of the building. And you as the audience are like, yeesh, well, that sounds pretty cut and dry to me. What about the lady who lived in the building across the street? And she saw the kid stab his father. You're getting it in a very, you know, it's expositional, but I think it's done pretty well. It's done the way you would discuss it in a jury room, I feel.
And it's the old woman, by the way, that was 45. Holy crap.
How did she even make it into the courtroom that day?
Yeah, and we have all these different men and they all have their different reasons. And some of them are incredibly racist. Some of them, I mean, racism is sort of the foundry, but none of them will admit to that. But I think a couple of them realize, well, we can't just convict somebody on that. Let's look at the evidence. And the evidence, I think, is very flimsy, but
it's super flimsy.
Right.
It would. Yeah.
I mean,
I was about to say it would never hold up today. But now I'm not so sure about that.
No, it would. I mean, people really do put a lot into what eyewitness evidence and ear witnesses, which is not actually something that's super reliable because your memory is not your memory. Your memory is a memory of a memory and blah, 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 blah. But they all have their reasons. Like, and that's how any case would set up, by the way. They're like, we think this is what happened and this is the evidence we have to prove the case. And it's not up to the defense to prove the negative. But people like it when the defense can prove a negative, can prove that it was another person versus we don't know who did it. Because then some of the jurors are like, well, you know, you're just going to let this kid go and he's going to kill somebody else, you know, or you're just going to let this murder happen and nobody's going to ever be convicted for it because they have no idea. And that is weighing on you. Like maybe he is guilty, but the evidence is pretty flimsy. And we could get into more specifics when we talk about the movie because they illustrate it really well there. But it's
Yeah, in the play, and I will say that, like, that's the one thing. And maybe because it was written as a teleplay, you kind of have to bring that into consideration because, as you said, they're filming it live. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of story that we're trying to get through, but we've also got the kind of cumbersome technology, these humongous cameras and lights and cords and cables and microphones, giant boom mics that they must have had. So you can't have the people like, you know, getting up and storming off, like that's not going to work in a teleplay.
Or improvising.
No, we can't have any of that. But so when you read it on the page, what I'm trying to say is when you read it on the page, it does feel, it's a little like we're really just going to sit around this table and talk and talk and talk. It's all it is. It's a bunch of 12 guys sitting around, literally sitting around a table, screaming at each other for an hour and a half. And yet, even on the page, it's very compelling. But and this is where I think the writing is just falls a little bit short. It's a super good story. I love the character development. But where I feel that the writing falls just a little bit short is that there's no, and I said this a couple of times this month, there's no levity. I mean, by levity, I mean, there's no, when human beings get uncomfortable, and to me, being in a hot room with 12 other people trying to decide whether another human being is going to live or not, that's about as uncomfortable as you could possibly be, right, apart from being that kid himself. We cannot help, I find, maybe it's because I was raised Catholic and we tend to have like church, what we call church giggles.
Yes.
You cannot help but to try and break that tension somehow. And it's written into the script, but the way it's written into the script, it doesn't really quite bring it over the line, you know? And so it makes the whole piece feel very, very heavy. It is a brick. And it's up to, but that's okay, because it's up to the actors. And then it really falls on the actors who are delivering that performance to add that those human, it's about how you deliver those lines. You could deliver them in a way that is completely joyless and humorless. And we could just slog our way through this hour and a half, or you can have, you know, really good actors who are really finding those moments and saying that line in just the right way. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised when I watched the movie, at the line deliveries, that some of the choices that these actors made that are just so masterful. But we'll talk about that in a second. So is there anything else you want to say about the play?
Well, let's just say that, you know, spoiler alert, in case you haven't heard about 12 Angry Men, they do come to the conclusion that the case wasn't proven. I don't know if they've proven to each other that he's completely innocent, but they definitely didn't prove the case. And they all have enough character to say, well, we can't do that. There's no way.
Yes.
And you would hope that if you were ever, God forbid, on trial, you would have people as thoughtful as this. That's also, I think, the message.
Yes. Like, absolutely.
Right. So it was a big success. Like I said, Studio One, you could find them on YouTube. They're just really pretty incredible. And then we get this movie, and this is the one and only time Henry Fonda produced a movie. He wanted to give it
How
a go.
About that?
Helped hire the director Sidney Lumet, who had directed a lot of Studio One productions and other TV productions, and they got the original writer, and they were like, okay, let's make this movie. And it turns out Henry Fonda hated going to dailies, like despised it, could not stand to look at himself. So he never could make choices because he saw it one time. He goes, I trust you, Sidney. And then he left, and then they never saw him again. And
he was a bit of an odd duck, wasn't he?
He was very odd. Very, very odd.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he and Sidney Lumet deferred their salaries in order to make the movie because it was a big cast. Mm. And they had a small budget. So the budget was like $300,000, but they had like 16 people they were paying. So they deferred it to get the profits from the movie. And the movie just doesn't do that. It's funny to think about it now because I see it on TV all the time.
It's so good.
And it's so good. And everyone loves it. And they play it in high schools and law schools.
Yeah.
But at the time, it didn't make a lot of money. So he's like, well, I didn't make any money.
I can't believe that.
Yeah. Should we play the trailer?
Yeah, let's do.
So this is the 1957 trailer for 12 Angry Men. We'll take a quick break and then we'll play the trailer.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On the point of that knife, a man's life is at stake.
I'm just saying it's possible.
And I say it's not possible. I want you to watch this because I don't want to have to do it again. I'll make myself about 6 or 7 inches shorter, okay?
It's about right, maybe a little more.
Okay, a little more.
Look out.
Here's what I think happened.
How can you be positive about anything?
I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing.
You are going to try a man for murder. The awesome power to kill will suddenly be thrust into your hand.
Watch them and pray, for someday you may become one of them. 12 men with the smell of violent death in their nostrils.
What's the matter with you guys? You're letting them slip through our fingers.
Slip through our fingers? Are you his executioner?
You cut it.
Ever since you walked into this room, you've been acting like a self-appointed public avenger.
Shut up.
You're a sadist.
12 men turned into 12 clawing animals.
Get him!
Movie, and you and I were saying off the air that there was a high school production, my school, and we had a couple of women in the cast. And I'm sure there's been productions where it's like 12 Angry Women. I'm guessing
there have been, yeah,
I'm sure.
And 12 Angry Jurors, I found a couple of those on YouTube.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, what's this? 12? Oh, yes, of course, it's a mixed gender cast,
but
12 Angry Jurors, it could just be jurors,
yeah, and they. The art direction and the cinematography here is fantastic.
Okay, this film is freaking brilliant. It is so good. Well, Sidney Lumet, first of all,
right?
Who we've talked about before, absolute genius. He is one of my favorite American filmmakers. I just think, again, his choices that he makes are so brilliant. Even the ones that seem controversial on paper, like showing at the beginning of the movie, showing the boy, which at first, like you hear that and you're like, you can't show the boy. Like the whole thing is you don't know about the boy. Like you don't know what but he somehow manages to find the one boy in the United States. No, I'm not. But the boy that he chooses is, first of all, he's got these haunting eyes. Mm-hmm. Secondly, like, you don't know what this child's ethnic background is, what it is at all. And I was trying to think, like, why did he do that? Why did he make that choice? I don't understand why, if the boy's 18 in the movie, I don't know if that was something that the studio made them do.
It
I don't
like get a that choice. Note.
Right? It doesn't sound like they wanted to do that. So to me, the reason that he chose to show the boy was so that we, the audience, can realize this is a kid. Because if you make him 18, it's a totally different conversation that these men are having. And the whole thing about the play is that he's 16. He's a kid, right. A kid who's had a very, very difficult life. And so I think that might have been why he decided to choose to show the boy, because you see that and you're like, he is a baby. Mm-hmm. And then I also love, like I said, that you cannot pin an ethnicity on this kid. I dare you.
Right.
He could be anything, which is great. I love that. And such a great choice. So then the whole time that they're arguing and they're like, well, he's 18, you know, which comes up a couple of times, you, the audience, is like, no, but did you see him? He's a baby.
He looks like
he does. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that might be, again, a very controversial choice, but I think it totally pays off. The choice to have them, there's a little part where, well, we'll get into it. Let's talk about the cast. We need to talk about this cast.
Right.
Oh, my gosh, this cast.
Well, so we'll just go juror 1 through 12.
Absolutely.
Martin Balsam. We talked about him when we talked about Psycho. He's so great. I love
Martin Balsam and Breakfast at Tiffany's. Balsam is so underrated. I love that man. He's so good in this.
Then we have John Fiedler.
Oh, Fiedler. The voice of Piglet.
Yes, and he did a ton of TV work in the 70s. And
didn't we talk about him with Harper Valley PTA? Isn't he in Harper Valley PTA?
Yes, he is in Harper Valley PTA. This is going to be hilarious. Lee J. Cobb is juror 3. We talked about him when we talked about The Exorcist. I think that's still there. It might be on the Patreon wall.
I adore Lee J. Cobb. He is... Well, he was, we should say, like, even at this point when this film is made, he is a giant of the American stage and was a formidable movie star, but he was the actor's actor. Like, I would say that Lee Cobb was probably the big get of this production.
I would agree with you. Mm-hmm. We have E.G. Marshall as juror 4, Jack Klugman. As juror 5, Quincy.
I just can't. I cannot.
Oscar Madison.
Another one like Martin Balsam, who is so brilliant and so underrated. He is, in many ways, I feel like he is the heart of this piece.
Mm-hmm. His eyes, the one, I mean. He's the one that grew up in a similar neighborhood. So he's the one that can bring that kind of information. Edward Binns is juror 6. Juror 7 is Jack Warden.
Come on. He's everything. Everything.
There's a great story in Charles Grodin's memoir. It would be so nice if you weren't here.
If you weren't here. I love that book.
So good. He talks about Jack Warden served in World War II and then with the GI plan went to acting school. But he was auditioning in New York. There's a story about him. He was auditioning in New York and he worked at a gas station and he came in for a reading for a Shakespeare play. And he was in his like garage gear, you know, with the oil and everything. And the guy looked at him and said, well, who are you here for? And he said, well, shit, who's playing Leah? Like, that's which is so just like him.
Wisecracker. He's great in this.
Oh, he's so
I
good.
Love him.
Henry Fonda is Davis. He's juror 8. And he's the one that's always said, he first says not guilty and makes them
he's
all
the
talk.
First holdout. Yeah.
Joseph Sweeney is McCardle, juror 9. Ed Begley, senior. Juror 10.
Oh, we should say Joseph Sweeney is the one who's the oldest member of the jury. And I think, didn't you say he was in the original teleplay?
He was indeed.
He's fantastic. He's
so good. George Voskovec, he's the European. He's juror 11.
Mm-hmm. And you said he was also in the in the original. Yeah. We should say Ed Begley, of course, Ed Begley Sr. It's Ed Begley Sr. Mm-hmm. Ed Begley Jr.'s dad. Ed Begley Sr., was another one. He's another one like Lee J. Cobb, that he was like Mr. Broadway. He was in everything. And those two together in this movie are so awesome. I just love it. Sorry. I couldn't let it go by.
No, of course. Him. It's Robert Weber is Juror 12.
He's the ad man.
He's the handsome younger ad man. Can't quite make up his mind.
Slick.
Very slick.
And slick and spineless.
The defendant is John Savoca. So he doesn't have any lines, but that's who that is.
He just sits there and haunts your dreams.
And yeah, I mean, how do you get all these characters to be so different from one another?
But you get brilliant actors is what you do. You get the best. Yeah.
So the scene, I love the scene where with the knife, where they're all saying like, well, how did this kid just happen to get this one pocket knife?
Look at this knife. No, you never saw a knife like this in your life.
My dad grew up in the 50s in New York. He's like, kids had knives. Like you needed... That's protection.
Oh, yeah. How about that? Like, okay, so it's a very famous, iconic scene. Like, if you look up 12 Angry Men, this is the scene that always kind of comes up.
What actually happened is this. The boy stayed home, had another fight with his father, stabbed him to death, and left the house at 10 minutes after 12. He even remembered to wipe the knife clean of fingerprints. Now, are you trying to tell me that this knife really fell through a hole in the boy's pocket? Someone picked it up off the street, went to the boy's house, and stabbed his father with it just to test its sharpness?
No, I'm just saying it's possible the boy lost his knife and that somebody else stabbed his father with a similar knife. It's just possible.
Take a look at this knife. It's a very unusual knife. I've never seen one like it. Neither had the storekeeper who sold it to the boy. Aren't you asking us to accept a pretty incredible coincidence?
I'm just saying a coincidence is possible.
And I say it's not possible.
Where did that come from?
It's the same knife.
You think you're doing?
Where did you get it?
I went out walking for a couple of hours last night. I walked through the boys' neighborhood. I bought that in a little pawn shop just two blocks from the boys' house. It cost $6.
It's against the law to buy or sell switchblade knives.
That's right. I broke the law.
Listen, you pulled a real bright trick. Now, supposing you tell me what it proves. Maybe there are 10 knives like that. So what?
Maybe there are.
But what does it mean? You found another knife like it. What's that, the discovery of the age or something?
You mean you're asking us to believe that somebody else did the stabbing with exactly the same kind of knife?
The odds are 1,000,001.
It's possible,
but not very probable.
Okay, fellas, let's take our seats. There's no point standing around all over the place.
You know, it's interesting that he'd find a knife exactly like the one the boy bought.
What's interesting about it? Interesting?
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting.
There are still 11 of us here who think he's guilty.
Right. What do you think you're going to accomplish? You're not going to change anybody's mind. So if you want to be stubborn and hang this jury, go ahead. The kid will be tried again and found guilty as sure as he's born.
Where these men are like, yeah, this is, you know, it was a very unusual knife. And Henry Fonda's like, oh, yeah. And he whips out an identical one and stabs it into the table. This cracks me up because these men, and this is in the script as well, like that the men all like jump back, clutching their pearls. It's illegal to buy a switchblade. I can't believe you broke the law and bought a switchblade, a dangerous weapon, my stars.
Heavens to Betsy.
That was the time.
That was the time. If you lived in certain parts of the city, yeah, that's what you had to do. But it's one of those things. And also, they're saying he stabbed his father with a knife going up and down into the person, which is just not how you use a knife. And I mean, we're more...
You don't use a switchblade like that. Mm-hmm.
I have like 20 years of Law and Order in my brain. So I just, you know.
As do we all now,
yes,
right?
Right. No, so it's nowadays, not shocking.
Yeah, a 21st century audience seeing that moment is like, well, duh.
Yeah.
You really thought that, you really thought this poor kid from a slum somehow got enough money to buy the one switchblade that looks exactly the only one in the world. How did he manage to outbid the Metropolitan Museum of Art to get this one switchblade? And then they also, I don't remember if it was in the movie, but I remember it in the script that it's also a point that the kid is very good with the switchblade because they had to have his friends testify, the kid's friends testify. And they're like, oh, yeah, he was really showing off that switchblade. He had all the skills and he knew how to use it. And he was showing us how cool the handle was and everything. Like, why? Really, was he like, oh, yeah, this is the knife I'm going to murder my dad with?
Right.
No. Who does that?
Nobody. I mean, if he was goofing with his friends, it's also, I would think, because he seems slight, he seems kind of small, that he's trying to show people, like, don't mess with me because I do have a knife. You know, I'm not going to be hostile about it right now, but just kind of let the word out, like, don't pick on
him. Yeah, I think it does say that in the script that he's kind of like a little guy.
Yeah, and it, people also tell us.
There's allusion to that.
Right, and then they give us reasoning, like, well, he was raised in a tough neighborhood. His mother died when he was young. He was arrested for things before. His father's not the greatest. And that's when you get the racism and the xenophobia of, and people always think like, oh, New York, it's so welcoming because we're the place for immigrants. And not everyone, believe me.
No, no.
I wish it were.
Well, the vote's 9-3 in favor of acquittal. I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing. You saw this kid just like I did. You're not going to tell me you believe that phony story about losing the knife and that business about being at the movies. Look, you know how these people lie? It's born in them. I mean, what the heck? I don't have to tell you. They don't know what the truth is. And let me tell you, they don't need any real big reason to kill someone either. No, sir. They get drunk. Oh, they're real big drinkers, all of them. You know that. And bang, someone's lying in the gutter. Well, nobody's blaming them for it. That's the way they are, by nature. You know what I mean? Violent. Where are you going? Human life don't mean as much to them as it does to us. Look, they're rushing it up and fighting all the time. And if somebody gets killed, so somebody gets killed, they don't care. Oh, sure, there's some good things about them, too. Look, I'm the first one to say that. I've known a couple who were okay, but that's the exception, you know what I mean? Most of them, it's like they have no feelings. They can do anything. What's going on here? Well, I'm trying to tell you. You're making a big mistake, you people. This kid is a liar. I know it. I know all about them. Listen to me. They're no good. There's not a one of them who's any good. I mean, what's happening in here? I'm speaking my piece, and you... Listen to me. We're this kid on trial here, his type. Well, don't you know about them? There's a danger here. These people are dangerous. They're wild. Listen to me. Listen.
I have. Now sit down and don't open your mouth again.
Someone trying to tell you.
I always wondered about that when I lived there, because it is true that you can, you know, even then in the 90s, like you go anywhere, you hear all the languages. And I would think back then it was less gentrified. So there mm-hmm. were these kind of silos of these different communities. And I just think it's because it's such a small place and everybody's just all squished in together, that just like being in that hot room, it kind of, you know, you squeeze a racist, guess what comes out?
Racism.
Right? So, I always kind of thought it was that it was just that it was so many people that, you know, you're bound to get some racists in there.
It just happens.
And like I said, it just happens. They're not so spread out and they don't get to, you know, they're not so separated that they're not encountering those communities on a daily basis.
We should also say in the 1950s, there's this teenage problem that is being pushed across the U.S.
In
news and in the entertainment at the time. And it's, you know, Marlon Brando, like, what are you rebelling against? What do you got?
Very good point. Yeah. What do you got?
What do you got? So there's this whole thing that teenagers are to be feared. Like, they were fun the previous generation. They were just like Bobby Soxers and whatever. But this new generation of kids, blah, like, just send them off. let's just cut our losses now, basically, that they were kind of, especially kids from the city, because this is also the time of urban flight and people are going to the suburbs.
That's right.
So who can afford to stay, you know, who can only afford to stay where they are?
And it's after the war. The suburbia is having its heyday. And so, yeah, the people who are in the cities are not the most affluent white people. They're not, you know, like you go to New York City today, everybody's a millionaire like in Manhattan. You cannot get a place to live for love nor money. It's not, you know, but in those days, the people who were in the city, kind of like when we talked about 7-year itch, the people who lived in the city were the working slobs. You know, if you were white and you were still living there among the non-white people, it's because you were not the highest person in your organization or, you know, at your place of work. You were the working slob, and they resent that, which I understand that. But yeah, you're right. That's a really good point, too, that is going on as well. And the audience would have been aware of that.
Yeah, there's teenage culture that is like taking over, and some of it's rough. And there, you know, bike gangs happened after World War II, and that bike gang culture is sort of out there. So there's this whole thing. There's us and them, and there are those kind of people, and there's our kind of people. And people still kind of divide themselves in this way, but they're arguing amongst each other. And the couple of them are trying to be super rational and say, well, this person hurt him, you know. And then you have to say, well, it's an L train. The elevated trains are so...
Did they?
Yes. Right. Like trying to explain, because some of them wouldn't know. I mean, right.
Yeah. When I was in college in Boston, I went to Boston University. The first semester that I lived there, I lived in a dorm that was next to the elevated, what do they call it there? The T. And it was this little segment of T that kind of ran between the buildings where the dorms were, because Boston University is in downtown Boston. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
When that train went by, like if you and I were 3 feet apart, we couldn't hear each other screaming at the top of our lungs. The whole building would shake every time, which freaked me out. Let me tell you, as a Southern Californian, like every time I was like, oh, this is the big one. And and then I'd be like, no, they don't have earthquakes here. That's why they have all these brick buildings still standing. But anyway, yeah, you wouldn't hear it. It's really cool. I just love the way they present the whole thing. It's so smart.
So they also have the old lady. So they have the old man who has a 45-foot apartment. I'm like, isn't that pretty big, don't you think? Or was I wrong?
It's massive.
Okay, that's what I said too.
It's like, freaking enormous.
He's doing pretty well, that old man.
He is fine.
He's doing fine. But they said like he was trying to hide his limp. He couldn't move that fast. And then we have the woman.
He had like a torn jacket that he was trying to, he had a tear in his jacket.
Well,
he's trying to hide.
The person there is the most empathetic and really notices the little details.
Yeah. So that's another kind of interesting. I love this work is so, so good because it explores the many, many, many ways that and everybody has them, that our biases color our perception of the quote unquote facts. We think that things that are just circumstance are facts for one thing. And we also make these assumptions about each other. And when the play starts, all of the men kind of, what's the word? Patronize the juror number. What is he? Number, whatever, the oldest one.
Yes.
Not Ed Begley Sr., but the other one who's even older. And because he's old, but as it turns out, he is by far, because he's lived the longest.
Right.
Hello. And he is therefore he knows the most about human nature. He is the most astute. He is the most observant. He has the most insight into every single thing that everybody's discussing. He is the smartest. He's really the smartest one at the table. The guy who Henry Fonda plays, who is interestingly an architect, think of the symbolism.
And all in white.
And all in white. But what I think is really fun about that character is he's like, I don't know. I just have a doubt. I just think it's possible. And they told us if we thought it was possible, and I'm not gonna, you know, I gotta say, I'm seeing some holes here. But I can't quite tell you why, but it seems to me like there's some, you know, I did find that knife and but it's that older gentleman who really has, he really backs it up.
They patronize him a couple of times and it's like, he may be the oldest. He's perfect eyesight still.
He's not wearing glasses.
He's not wearing glasses. Than I can. His hearing is fine. His abilities are all totally fine. He's just older. That's it. And so but he has a couple of them talk down to him because that's another thing. Like it's another bias that we have that older people aren't as valuable. But he's the one that picks up on the fact that this woman couldn't possibly see from that particular distance. She saw a blur that she has to if she saw anything.
Yeah.
And people can remember things in their own way too. Like,
of course.
Yeah.
And which he also points out, and I think if anybody is the one who has convinced all of the other men to switch their original verdict, it's him. He's really the one who talks them into it. And it's only because, now we will say, like, Henry Fonda's character is the fact that he's so unsettled. He doesn't want to say, I have absolutely no doubt that the kid did it. He is the one that plants it in the older man's mind, like, oh, maybe I should really think about this. If this guy's not convinced, okay, let me. And he starts really kind of turning it over in his mind. But in terms of persuasiveness, he's the persuader in the room.
Right. He has the most guts, too. Yeah. I mean, yeah, Jack, but there's great little touches like Jack Klugman.
Oh, Jack Klugman is so, he's so good in this. I mean, the only reason that Quincy was a thing and that it was around for those scripts are horrible. I'm sorry. They are absolutely terrible. And you know what? I watched every single one.
Me and my mom.
Jack Klugman, baby.
Yes, we loved him.
He is the best. Love him. Just like Angela Lansbury, you know, yes. Like, it's, if it were anybody but Angela Lansbury, they would be unwatchable, but she's brilliant. Same thing. He's so good. And the way that he, in this film, which I love, because you and I grew up watching him as Oscar Madison.
Yes.
And then later as Quincy. And the two things, and they're very different characters, but the two things that they have in common, those two guys, is they are very outraged, both of them. And so they both blow up, but for one for funny reasons and the other one for not funny reasons. And so you and I grew up watching Jack Klugman like blow up.
Right.
And yell and scream and throw things and, you know, which is hilarious, or it's also like very dramatic. In this film, he is quietly sitting there and he's not saying anything. And he looks a little bit worried. And then when he does pipe up, we learn that he pipes up very quietly. We learn that he grew up he lives to a similar background to this kid somehow. And the way that he says it and the way his demeanor afterwards is like, you see him trying so hard to fit into this room,
right,
of mostly white men. Like he's trying
and they're saying terrible things
to not ruffle feathers, not get involved, not stand out. Whereas juror number 11, he's an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And he can't hide that he's an immigrant. He's got an accent, right? And he is, but he really believes in the United States. He really believes in this innocent until proven guilty. And he's not afraid to take a stand. He's already like, I'm not going to fit in. I open my mouth and as soon as I open my mouth, I don't fit in anymore. Right. I'm not going to even try. Whereas Jack Klugman's character is trying so hard while they're saying horrible things about people like him.
His background, the people like him. And then we have Jack Warden, who just wants to go to a ball game and is so obsessed with his ball.
He's so good.
He's so great, but, you know, 1957 Yankees, yeah, sure. But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, I got a ball game to go. Let's just fry this kid. Let's just do this right now. Why are we
He's even guilty. All right, he's not guilty. Can we just go?
Yeah. It's just great. It's just really wonderful.
And then Lee J. Cobb.
And he cries.
Lee J. Cobb. Are you kidding me? This is why he's the best. This is why he's the king. Because he's so angry and he's so blustery. He's the last holdout. So when it starts, everybody agrees the kid's guilty, but you have the one holdout, and that's Henry Fonda. And when pressed, Henry Fonda's like, yeah, I just don't feel like I can say he's definitely guilty. As the play goes on, you know, it reverses. And then now the last holdout is Lee J. Cobb. And same thing, when pressed, he's like, I just feel like he's guilty. He doesn't have great reasons. But it comes out like he has this estranged relationship with his own son.
That he beat, by the way.
That he beat himself, just like the boy, the murderer boy beat his own father. His father beat him.
Beating him up, right. And so he, yes, in retaliation this one time, they're saying.
Allegedly.
Yes. Yeah. Stabbed him, right.
Where, right.
Lee J. Cobb said he was turning his son into a man. And then when he got bigger, yes, than him, he became physically bigger than him. So he knocked him back one day. And that's when
he left and never came back.
They didn't have a relationship. They didn't have a good relationship.
And so he has that. And so he's this blustery. There's a lot of bravado and what do they call that? Testosterone fueled, you know,
toxic
chest beating and toxic masculinity. Thank you. There's a lot of that. It's a lot about that. Ed Begley Sr. is very blustery too. But the king of that is Lee J. Cobb's character. And he is he's always trying to just like shout everybody down, even though, right, he doesn't have anything to back it up. He's just loud and
that's how he gets through life. I'm sure
that's how he gets through life.
Yeah, that's a strategy.
And then at the end, like, oh my gosh, the photo of him and his kid. Yeah. I cannot. And then to see that big gorilla of a man who's been shouting and screaming and he talks about punching his kid and everything, to see he is sobbing.
And what about this business of the L and the movies? There's a phony deal if I ever heard one. I bet you $5,000 I'd remember the movies I saw. I'm telling you, everything that's gone on has been twisted and turned. This business with the glasses? How do you know she didn't have them on? This woman testified in open court. And what about hearing the kid yell? Huh? I'm telling you, I've got all the facts here. Well, that's it. That's the whole case. Well? Say something! You lousy bunch of bleeding hearts. You're not going to intimidate me. I'm entitled to my opinion. Rotten kids, you work your life out!
Not guilty.
Because that could have been him, he realizes. Like, you know, yeah, he just, she didn't want to wear glasses. She wanted to look gorgeous. Okay. Like, he's so... Like,
and it's funny. That's the thing is they all it's again, it's in the delivery of the lines, because when you read it on the page, it doesn't come off like that. It's just super, super heavy, nothing but solid drama. Yeah, his delivery of that, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
And with the cinematography, by the way, we should say, and I've Sidney Lumet's book, because we've talked about it a few times. With the cinematography, they had the camera angles from far distance away. And then as the movie progresses,
yes,
it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And there's much more.
We're looking
close-ups
at their pores at the end.
You really are. You see them sweating they're just sweating all over. They look miserable. Mm-hmm. When that stupid little fan comes on, that must feel amazing compared to. But he then changes his vote. He realizes that, you know, he can't justify his position anymore. He also just has so much more empathy. And so, and I like that Henry Fonda helps him put his coat on and, And I'm sure, and I always picture in my head, like, oh my God, that DA must have been shocked when they came into the room and said that. Because I'm sure he thought he had it in the bag.
Seriously. And I don't think that's in the script that Henry Fonda's character goes over and like helps him with the coat and helps him out of the room.
No, I think that's just something they have. Yeah.
And yeah.
But they said that's part of it. Like they create all this tension. And it's great. And it's wonderful. And it's shot in New York at, you know, at the state, at the courthouse downtown. And
oh, and then when they're all walking again, this isn't not in the play at all, of course. But then we get this long shot of the courthouse steps and the men coming out and the oldest gentleman just connecting with Henry Fonda at the end and introducing himself by name. And then at the very, 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 very bitter end, you see Lee J. Cobb just like slumping down the stairs of the court. Oh, come on. Come on.
It's so good.
So brilliant. It was such a good movie.
It was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Adapted. And I think Henry Fonda was nominated as well. It's the same. This is what happens sometimes. It was the same year that The Bridge on the River Kwai was nominated for everything. And it just won everything. And that's just what happens.
It's a big production. I mean, it's a good movie. It's a big production. And this is, it's a good movie. This is all in a room. And right. Yeah, it happens.
And it wasn't as big of a hit. And that's sometimes a part of it as well. But it becomes this classic. And then my high school did it. It was 12 Angry Jurors. I realize now that's popping in my head. That was in the 80s. And then 97 HBO did a version. And it had Jack Lemmon and Tony Danza. It's a really cool cast. It's the same thing. I think it's fine. If you want to see it, it's fine. I say, really, the movie is much better. And I think
this movie is so brilliant.
It's just so brilliant.
It's so brilliant. It's so well done. All the angles, the way that the set is constructed. I love the scene. They bring in the floor plan of the old man's apartment down below, downstairs,
that
and they
mansion
walk the,
he lives in. Sorry,
it's bigger than my whole house.
I know.
Can I, just
I
say,
kept saying like down my hallway. I was trying to figure it out my hallway. I'm like, it is.
It is
near
not
that.
A short distance. No. Yeah, it's like twice the size of my house.
I know. It's too.
Yeah, just the whole like the artistry of the lighting. The lighting is so good. Everything in this movie is absolutely spot on. Yeah, man, it holds up. Here's my question, though, because I just cannot understand why this was not a monster hit. Because what do you call, which we talked about doing, A Few Good Men. A Few Good Men was a monster hit. Is it because, might it be because audiences just were not used to courtroom drama like we are now? It was not that big of a part of our culture yet. And so
I'm just looking at what were the top movies. The Seventh Seal, Funny Face, Gunfight at the OK Corral, Sweet Smell of Success. That's a really amazing movie.
Mm-hmm.
Face in the Crowd, which we covered.
Oh, yeah.
Peyton Place.
Okay, those are a lot of really good movies.
Old Yeller.
Okay.
310 to Yuma. Jailhouse Rock came out this year.
Okay, so you know what? It might have just been that. It might have just been the wrong year.
It's sometimes, yeah. We're always shocked. Like when something becomes a classic, like, wait a minute, this wasn't like people didn't wait in line for this. I would.
Yeah.
It's a great date movie because you have something to talk about afterwards.
Yeah. It's super good and it totally holds up. I don't know how you don't get bored being in that room with those men, but you don't, because they're just acting their butts off and it's so good.
Well,
it's so
also,
good.
You don't know how it turns out.
Yeah. you know, even though that's the thing is like, even though, okay, look, I knew how it turned out. I've seen this movie. And now this week I read the play. And so I really know how it turns out. I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. I know what's coming. But because these actors are so good and because this is so well directed, I am still on the edge of my seat.
Right.
And I notice something different every time. So good. So movie. I mean, it's not even close.
I know. That's our hot take.
Yeah. So we're taking a teensy, we're not diving right into African American History Month. So we are still looking for suggestions.
Yes, please.
So we do have something that we're planning to do next week, which I'm excited about because this has come up a few times in the Facebook group.
It has. And I don't know if it's an anniversary or something. I've been seeing it on Twitter lately, but it's Duel. So it's the Richard Matheson, and it's a short story by Richard Matheson. The movie comes out in 1973. It was a TV movie directed by Steven Spielberg. Spielberg is all over. He's been nominated for Oscars again this year. Maybe that's it. They're going back to his first work.
Oh, you know what? That could be it.
It's a thriller.
But he is Mr. Adaptation.
Yes.
We've talked about him so many times because he's good at it.
He's great at it. And he's like in his early to mid 20s when he comes out with Duel, which changed everything. Once again, he was a game changer. It's a thriller. It's Dennis Weaver, and he's basically being chased by a truck. And I can't wait to read the story. You can find Richard Matheson's books in Libby. I found it very quickly on the Libby app. It's a 20-page short story, really easy to dive into. And then the movie's going to be amazing. I can't wait.
I haven't seen it in many years. It really freaked me out when I remember seeing it as a kid and just like being so scared. Cause we used to take so many road trips. So it freaked me out.
Same. Yeah. Oh yeah. Same reason.
But I'm excited to see it.
Please follow us in all those places I mentioned at the top of the show and give us your suggestions. Our email once again is bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com. And Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com, and all of my social media callouts are at She's Nacho Mama. And where can they find you?
You can find me. I've changed my name on Twitter. You could still find me if you've already, but I've changed to Brooklyn Margo. And then I was going to do that for Instagram.
Good call.
Yeah. So it's Brooklyn Margo on Twitter. Trying to figure out on Instagram what to do because there's already a Brooklyn Margo there. But
and tell them why.
Because I have a book called Filmed in Brooklyn. And so I'm now like a kind of a Brooklyn film expert. Thank you, Margo. The link is in also, you can follow me there. I pinned the link on my Instagram is Brooklyn Fitchick, and my site is brooklynfitchick.com. All the information is there if you want to look into my book. If you want to get a signed copy, email us and we'll work that out. And my TikTok, which Margo, I've been learning how to do video editing. So I've been upping my TikTok and my social media game. So
I'm gonna have to actually download the app.
You should. BookTok is a big deal.
I know it is. I'm just so like, I'm just so old, but I'll do it.
And so you can find me there at Margo Donahue. This has been super fun. And we are looking forward to the next episode. And once again, as Margo said, we are looking for suggestions. African American History Month, and we have musicals in March and AAPI in May or April. There's a lot coming up, y'all. So giddy up. Thanks for joining.
What's your name?
Davis.
My name's McCardle. Well, so long.
So long.
Thank you so much.